Welcome again to another episode of Legends Among Us, a podcast devoted to the troopers and veterans of 3rd Cavalry Regiment. And this week we have another veteran of this organization, someone who has contributed greatly to the history and the formation of troopers within 3CR. I want to welcome this afternoon Lieutenant Colonel retired Jeff Hernandez, who serves currently as the 3rd Cavalry Regiment Association President. Did I get that correct?
So 3rd United States Cavalry Association.
Thank you. Thank you for that correction, sir. I appreciate that.
No worries.
And I'm going to leave that in there, too, for the the listening audience, because there's a lot that I need to learn. But, Jeff, thank you for joining us this week.
Absolutely.
It's good to have you here. As we take episodes to dig into 3rd Cavalry Regiment's history, we try to bring people on who can contribute to that. And I believe that you have a lot to share just from your foxhole, your own experiences. As I mentioned, we had Sergeant Major Webster here for recording a couple days ago, and he shared what the regiment looked like in the 80s and the 90s, which was really great to hear. But I know that you have some experiences going back to the early 2000s and into the teens as well. So would love to hear about that, and we'll get into that eventually. But could you just, as I do with everybody else, just kind of give us a little bit of your backstory, how you came into the Army and how you ended up in 3rd Cavalry Regiment? Clearly it's had an impact on you, otherwise you would not be the president of the association.
Yep. I joined the Army back in December of 1989. The reason I did it was because my sister was getting ready to graduate from high school. And I was already seeing how much of a burden me going to college was on my parents. Right. And so my sister also wanted to go to the same school I was going to, which was UTSA at the time. And I knew that my parents weren't going to be able to support both of us. So I figured, hey, let me do something to help out my parents and also to help out myself. So I joined the reserves. I spent 4 years in the reserves, then 3 years active duty enlisted, and then 1 year in the guard. So 8 years enlisted time. And then jumped over to the dark side through ROTC. Came in 2001 as an active duty officer, quartermaster. Eventually became logistics. And then did 22 years as an officer before retiring in November of 2023.
So 2023 is when you retired. You're still here in Texas, obviously. Again, like Sergeant Major Webster, this is where you've chosen to retire. But it sounds like you're from Texas.
Yes. So I'm from Texas. I'm actually from McAllen, Well, really the entire Rio Grande Valley. My dad was a coach, a high school coach, as I was growing up. So we kind of bounced around the Rio Grande Valley, depending on what opportunities would present themselves for him to either get a head coaching job or to get, you know, better pay to be able to support the family and stuff. So we kind of bounced around a lot. But the last maybe 8-9 years of my school days, so to speak, we stayed in McAllen. So we call McAllen home.
Okay. And do you still have family down there?
Or? So my mother-in-law still lives in McAllen. Everybody else is out of McAllen. My mom is in San Antonio along with my sister. My brother is in Austin. And my dad passed away in 1999.
Well, you've had, I think as we were walking over here, you mentioned that you've had a few tours within 3CR.
Like, yes.
Can you go back in time and tell us a little bit about those?
Okay, so my first time with the regiment was in 2006 to 2009. Okay. So I actually came here in March of 2006 and was assigned as the Echo Company 1-1 Aviation Commander. So at the time, 1-1 Aviation was doing what was called the Unit Fielding and Training Program with 21st Cavalry Brigade, which was out here on Hood Army Airfield. They were already designated to reflag to 4th Squadron, 3rd Cavalry Regiment, 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment at that time. So it was only a couple months that I was Echo 6, and then I became Renegade 6. Renegade Troop was actually an attack helicopter troop that history goes back. They started with Cobras, then they became the only troop that had Apaches in the regiment, up until 2006 when UFTP was executed, and then the regiment turned in their Kiowas and then fielded nothing but Apaches. They still had a Blackhawk troop And then they still had an AVIM as well.
So just for my own edification and understanding, Long Knife was the only squadron that had rotary wing assets. Is that correct at one point in time?
Correct. Yeah. So Long Knife, before its current inception, mm-hmm. was a rotary wing formation that consisted of both attack helicopters and lift helicopters.
Okay.
So you had both. Well, when they were at Carson, you had Kiowas and Apaches and the Blackhawks. When they came here to Fort Hood, they fielded straight up Apaches, and then they still had their formation of Blackhawks.
Okay. Did you have any combat rotations when you were here the first time?
Yes. Yeah. So okay. OIF 0709, I deployed with, or deployed as Renegade 6 with Long Knife. We went to Taji, just north of Baghdad. The rest of the regiment, for the most part, was up north in Mosul, except for Sabre Squadron, which went out to Diyala Province along the Iranian border.
Okay. Were you all operating independently, or were you OpCon to any other
higher? So we were attached to 12th Combat Aviation Brigade out of Germany.
Okay.
And basically, it was a task force. So 4th ID's Aviation Brigade was supposed to actually go in and replace 1st Cav's Aviation Brigade. Mm-hmm. But because of all the timing of reset and everything else, whether it was personnel or equipment, they weren't ready. And so the Army's temporary fix was, okay, hey, 12th Cab, you're going to assume part of the operating environment for Baghdad. 4th Squadron, 3rd CR is going to be assigned to you. They'll be your attack assets. 12th Cab basically only had lift assets that came out of, you know, a little bit further north from Taji. And then we operated as a task force for basically, I want to say it was 8 months.
And so was that your only rotation during that time period? I know that was during the height of the surge, 06.
Yeah, so that was, that was my only rotation with the regiment during that stint. And then when I came back to the regiment, 2013, I deployed to Afghanistan.
Okay. Came back here in 2013. What capacity were you?
So I started off as Rifles 4.
Okay.
And then I moved over to be Muleskinner 8.
Okay. It said you deployed to Afghanistan during that time. How are you all employed?
The interesting thing about 2014 was the regiment was, as we say, there's a poster that Jody Harmon did for us. The sun never sets on the 3rd Cavalry Regiment. Mm. And the reason for that was because we actually had personnel deployed to Afghanistan, to Egypt, to Cuba, and then to the Washington, D.C. area.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And okay. So as Rifles 4, trying to get ready for not one deployment, but 4 deployments.
Sure.
You know, it was only a troop going to Cuba and a troop going to Washington, D.C. Hmm. But we had an entire squadron go to Egypt.
Bright Star. Was that the...
Well, Bright Star is the exercise that they normally do while they're there. But they were there as the multinational force observers.
Oh, okay.
So they were there for a year.
Okay.
And then we were in Afghanistan. At that time, it was only supposed to be a 9-month deployment, but because it was already the beginning of the drawdown, some of us were sent back at the 6-month mark.
So when you look back on those two different times that you were here, what are some of the similarities perhaps within the culture? What are some differences that maybe you can look back and observe?
So similarities-wise, I would just say the spirit of the Cav was able to kind of cross over, you know. When we converted from an armored cavalry regiment formation to a cavalry regiment / striker formation, that occurred in between those two deployments. So it was like right as I left the regiment the first time, they went and did Operation New Dawn. Mm-hmm. And then when they came back, they turned in their tanks and brads and they drew their strikers. And so then when I got back to the regiment, now it's a striker formation. So that's one of the big differences is that the ACR mentality was gone. So an armored cavalry regiment was basically the eyes and ears of 3 Corps. Mm. And so we had this tendency to be able to operate alone and unafraid. That was the mentality that we had. Whereas as a striker formation, you were basically just like any other striker brigade combat team in the Army. We didn't have a lot of the specialty formations that we had as an armored cavalry regiment, so we didn't have aviation anymore, right?
Yeah.
Helicopters went away.
Yeah.
Long Knife became a ground reconnaissance squadron, the RISTA. We lost our engineer troop, went away. And so We didn't see the engineers come back to the formation until the res stood up in 2015. So there was a few years there where you had a couple of engineers on the regimental staff, but that was pretty much it. And then there were some other enablers that the regiment had when we were in ACR that we no longer had as a striker formation.
So I won't get into like the technical details, but I'm sure you're aware of the fact that we're going back to an ACR model.
Well, so we're going to an Armored Brigade Combat Team model, right? But we're going to call ourselves an ACR again.
Yes.
But no aviation, right? Coming back.
Correct.
Still not going to have your own like MI company. You're not going to have your own engineer company. Some of the other enablers that we used to have. So,
of course, there will be some nuances with regards to what kind of assets we will have versus what we won't have. But my understanding is two of the three infantry squadrons are going to be redesignated as armor squadrons. So with that being said, and like Long Knife, they're almost like a provisional detachment right now, but in a few years they'll be at full strength again, as they were not too long ago.
Yep.
With that being said, knowing that there's going to be a change at some point in time, how do you foresee 3CR, which will eventually become, again, 3ACR, change culturally with regards to the type of soldier that we have here? How does the soldier, the trooper, change the culture, knowing that we're going to go less infantry and more tanker heavy? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, so the way I see it is, regardless of what branch the trooper is, right? If the trooper buys into the mentality of they're in a cavalry formation, then as long as they have the skill, fitness, panache, dash, and discipline of a cavalry trooper and they carry on that spirit, then it really shouldn't be too significant of an impact as far as making the transition. At the end of the day, what it really boils down to is how is the leadership communicating task and purpose, right? Regardless of whether it's an infantry trooper I'm communicating to, or it's a cavalry trooper or armored trooper that I'm communicating to.
You talked about, I like you use the word panache, because you don't hear that word used very often. But the spirit of the Cav, which I was really exposed to when we were in Korea, and it was a new, kind of a new world. I mean, everybody's heard of the 1st Cavalry Division. Most people have heard of 3rd Cavalry Regiment. But not everybody is familiar with the insider status that I would say comes with being a part of an organization like 3CR. So how do we as leaders communicate that or instill that, or does it require a degree of buy-in from the troopers that we provide, or do they just need to like come here, see what this organization is like, and then make the decision themselves? Like, I'm either going to buy into this wholeheartedly or I'm going to reject it.
I mean, I think it doesn't matter what the rank of the trooper is, right?
Right.
At the end of the day, it's about how you communicate, like I said a little while ago, task and purpose, right?
Yeah.
Like, hey, when I came to the regiment the first time, you know, I came from 1st Cav, went to the career course, and then came back here thinking I was going to go to 1st Cav. And they're like, oh, no, you're going to go over here to this 1-1 aviation. And I was like, why am I going to 1-1 aviation? You know, I want to be in the cavalry.
Yeah.
Right? And then finding out that, okay, yeah, we're reflagging the 3rd Cavalry Regiment. So the buy-in for me wasn't hard, right? Because I had already come from a cavalry formation. I had had two stints in 1st Cavalry Division, one enlisted, one as an officer. So I think it was kind of like what was instilled in me was very easy for me to communicate to the junior troopers upon their arrival, or even to my lieutenants, or even to the warrant officer that we had within the formation.
So as I think about newer troopers now, even ones that have only been here for a few months, how do they find themselves gravitating towards that culture themselves? Like, what were the things that you did or observed that really endeared you towards the Cav culture that are still apply today?
So I think the first thing is history, right? Understanding what the history of the organization is. So like when I was in 1st Cav, I was in the 12th Cavalry Regiment, 2nd Battalion, 12th Cavalry Regiment. So one of the things that, you know, if you're going to go to the promotion board, you have to study the history, not just of the division, not just of the brigade, but also of the 12th Cavalry Regiment itself, right? And so kind of digging into that a little bit and understanding like where they had been throughout their history, you know, whether it was out on the plains in the west or even being down in the Rio Grande Valley, which is where I'm from, right? My daughter-in-law lives in Rio Grande City, Texas. She's a state trooper for the state of Texas. That's where she lives right now because my son's deployed over to Latvia. When we go visit her, you know, as I'm driving down the road, I see, first of all, the detachment that I was assigned to when I first came in the Army. But right behind that is Fort Ringgold. Well, the 12th Cavalry was based at Fort Ringgold back in the early 1900s. And so I think if you're able to find ways to kind of tie in to the history,
yeah,
that's the first thing that kind of brings that buy-in. The second thing for me was a spur ride. So, okay, hey, you know, you went to the board. Now you're going to do a spur ride. Oh, by the way, you know, you have to go to a board for the spur ride because you have to show that you know the history of the formation. You understand the customs and traditions of the 1st Cavalry Division with respect to, like, the wear of the Stetson, the wear of the spurs, all that kind of stuff. And so having leaders that kind of, like, pushed you towards that to be able to do those things, I want to say empowered me as a leader coming back to the regiment or coming to the regiment the first time to be able to communicate, hey, this is why the Cav is important. This is why 3rd Cavalry Regiment is important, right? Like, we are the longest continuously serving regiment in the history of the Army. It's not any different from any other formation. At the end of the day, it's still the trooper has to buy into it.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I think 2nd Cavalry Regiment has 10 years on us.
So the 2nd was formed prior to the 3rd, but the 2nd also had a break in service.
Okay, that's what I was wondering about.
So that's the two differences. Okay. They are the oldest cavalry regiment, whereas we are the oldest continuously serving regiment.
Got it. So I will just straight up ask this question. Do you believe, because you see troopers come into the gift shop every day. I'm sure you have had several interactions with them over the past several years. Are we instilling those same standards and same ideals in the hearts and minds of troopers today as leaders within this organization?
I would say that it's kind of hit or miss. It depends on either the squadron or the troop that they're in, right? As a leader, the first thing we have to do, you know, when I say we, it's, you know, I'm part of the association now. But when I was still in the formation, when I was still wearing the uniform, you have to get the leaders to buy into it. So one of the things that the regiment kind of struggled with during the transition from an ACR to a striker formation was now all of a sudden you had a bunch of 11 series coming in, right? And getting them to buy into the Cav was a little difficult.
Sure.
Why is that? Because there's a rivalry between armor, Cav, and infantry guys, right?
Right.
You know, and they all talk smack to each other and everything else. And sometimes you have guys who have primarily grown up entirely in either light infantry formations, whether it be the 82nd, the 101st, or 10th, or the 25th. And so then they come here and they're not used to a heavy formation, right? Even if it's striker, it's still heavier than a light formation, right? And so trying to get them to, you know, kind of buy into the mentality and understand it and everything else is part of the challenge of being a leader in the formation, to get them to understand, okay, hey, yeah, this is not, we're not the 82nd, right? We're not jumping out of airplanes. This isn't the 101st. We're doing a whole bunch of air assaults. We have that capability, but we have to reach out to our friends in 1st Cav or into other divisions to be able to utilize their air assets. Whereas when we were the ACR, we could do all those things, right? We had 11 series in the formation. We had tankers. We had artillerymen. We had aviators. The mindset of the ACR was we were a combined arms formation and everyone was a scout. Everyone was a scout. It didn't matter whether you were a cook, whether you were a supply guy, whether you were a transporter, an MI guy, a signal guy, everybody was considered a scout. And so that was the mentality in the formation. And trying to build that once we became a striker formation was a challenge.
So that transition has come and gone. We've been a striker unit for quite some time now. Have we gotten past that mentality, or do we still have struggles in terms of unit cohesion?
From my foxhole, I don't think it's a struggle with unit cohesion, but I just think it's a struggle with buy-in. And I think part of that is just because, once again, if I can't get leaders to buy into the cavalry mentality, vice, hey, I'm an infantryman. That's the one thing that I've seen. Not to say that there aren't infantrymen that have bought into the cavalry mentality, but I think it's a little bit harder for the leaders to try to sell it to guys who are coming from the 82nd or the 101st or 10th, who have pretty much spent their entire career in those types of formations.
Sure. Well, shifting gears a little bit, I wanted to talk about your role in the association. I'm assuming before you became the president that you were involved with the association for a period of time. How long have you been?
So I joined the association the first time when I came to the regiment. And back then it was kind of more like a cup and flower fund type of thing.
Right.
So we were not necessarily formalized as an association, you know, a 501c19. It was more of a unofficial association. And then Command Sergeant Major Harvey Reed, who used to be the executive director for the association, and Colonel Quinn, who was the president at the time, they're kind of like the ones who like pushed us to the next level of, okay, hey, let's formalize things. Let's get a board going. Let's kind of take that away from the green suiters so that they can focus on what they need to do. And now we actually had a little bit of a backbone, so to speak, to kind of like get the ball rolling. Initially, it was the majority of the membership was people who were actually in the ACR at the time, 2006, 2007 timeframe when the regiment came from Carson here. But it took a little while to get the ball rolling. I mean, it was funny because a couple weeks ago before I went on vacation and stuff, I'm going through some of the file folders that are still in the office that Command Sergeant Major Reed had, and there's some traffic between green suiters who were trying to kind of fill the role before he moved down from Carson to here. And, you know, they're kind of like getting mad at each other about, I don't know how to do this and I don't know how to do that, you know. So Sergeant Major Reed was really instrumental in kind of pushing things. And then it became even more formal because then when I came back to the regiment, I joined again. And now we had like, you know, this really cool membership card along with the certificate. And there seemed to be a little bit more organization as far as how the association was being run, and a lot of that had to do with Colonel Quinn and Sergeant Major Reed. And then when Colonel Teeples came on as the honorary to replace Colonel Quinn was dual hatted, he was the honorary and the president. But when Colonel Teeples came on board as the honorary, you know, he started kind of pushing the whole history thing, understanding the history of the regiment and what it's supposed to do. And then he was able to network to get a lot of the older membership to start coming back, either for a reunion or whenever we would have some sort of event here. But prior to becoming the president, my activity was solely just a member. Prior to me becoming the president, Mike Garlington was the president. Mike used to be Mule Skinner 6. When he retired in 2018, he was approached by the board to become the new president for the association. Sergeant Major Reed was still the executive director. Mike came on and served as a president for 5 years and kind of, you know, pushed us in a direction to continue to grow. And he was still working, and he knew that when I retired that my plans were I wasn't going to work. So he kind of approached me at the colors casing ceremony for the regiment before you guys went to Korea. And afterwards, he's like, hey, let's go have lunch over at the PX. So we go to have lunch, and there's a couple of other guys there who are members of the board. And he's like, I want you to become the next president for the association. And I was like, sure. And here I am.
Was that the nomination? Did anybody vote? Or was
Well, that was just a discussion for that he wanted to gauge my interest. Okay. Was I willing to do it? A couple weeks or maybe even a month later, then there was a formal board meeting.
Okay.
Which I had to sit in on, and then, you know, Mike basically proposed the nomination to the board. They asked me to kind of give a little bit of a background and stuff like that, you know, not just of the regiment, but why would I be good to serve as the president for the association? And the board went ahead and approved the nomination. And hey, here's the keys. Go off and do great things.
So how long is your term?
So the term can be anywhere between 2 to 5 years.
Okay.
We recently updated our bylaws because, as Mike said, it's kind of hard to get something accomplished in a 2-year period. You know, it's almost like when you're a brigade or a regimental commander, right? You come in, you have a vision, you know where you kind of want to go. So when I came on board, Mike already kind of had a document that he had created of, hey, here's where I think we need to go. So I'm basically running with his vision, and then I've added my little pieces in based upon what I've observed over the last 16 months.
Obviously, the association exists for a purpose that I could say generically is to provide resources for troopers and veterans, but that would not come close to describing what you all actually exist for. What services do you provide? What is your relationship like with the veteran community, with the troopers that are currently on active duty?
So the biggest thing that I see us as far as task and purpose is to continue the customs traditions of the regiment. So, you know, as we get ready to make that transition back, there aren't any troopers that are currently in the formation that probably served in the ACR.
Right.
So they don't understand what that is. And so the association has a responsibility to the formation to be able to provide some of that insight, to be able to have touch points with the currently serving troopers, to be able to communicate with them about, you know, hey, here's some things that you're going to need to be thinking about. Here's some things to be aware of that could, you know, kind of hold you back. Of course, our experiences are dated, but a lot of times those communications are with leaders, right? Yes. Because those experiences, regardless of whether it was 10 years ago or it's going to be next year as the transition begins to occur, you know, as Rifles 4, dealing with the transition of converting from flat bottom strikers to double V-hull strikers. So that whole turn in of strikers to get new ones is not going to be very different from what the regiment will experience when they get ready to turn in their strikers now to go to Fort Carson, and then the tanks and Bradleys come from Fort Carson here. And so I've communicated to Rifles 4, hey, I know that the processes are probably a little bit different or whatever, but I can share at least some insight into what some of the hiccups were that you may need to be thinking about. Because a lot of times I wish I had had somebody to tell me, oh, you got to know this and you got to know this and you got to know that, as we executed that turn in of the flat bottoms.
So you really do exist in almost like an advisement type of capacity. Like, that is a function that you all provide to some of our senior leaders. I mean, this seems like one of those appropriate times where you would come alongside them because they're old enough and mature enough to understand perspective. Mm-hmm. So it's not like you're coming to them with irrelevant data. You actually have some experience that, when applied logically, can actually benefit the organization as we do transition back to being a heavy unit. What other ways do you all advise the command?
It just depends on what. A lot of times a command will be looking for stuff where they may need some support. And so they may come to us and ask us, you know, hey, we're planning on having this event. Is there any way that the association can support? And then we'll propose it to the board. The board will vote, make a determination. And then if it's something that we can do, then we'll do it. But I mean, you know, Sergeant Major Webster, who we talked to a couple of days ago, right? So every week he's down at Pegasus Troop and he's briefing troopers that are coming into the division and into the regiment about both associations, 1st Cav Division Association and then the 3rd U.S. Cav Association, you know, letting them know. Sometimes, you know, the troopers will be like, oh yeah, you know, they'll lead it up, right? And they may either show up at the gift shop where they're scanning the QR code and they're joining whichever association it is they're going to be a part of. But sometimes it goes over their head. And so we're always trying to communicate that when they come to the gift shop, because where are they going to get their Stetson? Where are they going to get their pins that they need for either their AGSU or some of their other uniform items that they might need? Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the services that we provide, right, is being able to have that stuff so they don't necessarily have to leave the regimental footprint,
right,
and try to go to clothing and sales and find it, who 9 times out of 10, they don't carry the stuff that we carry.
Yep.
Right? They'll carry the distinctive unit insignia, and they'll carry plain cross sabers, but they don't carry like 4th Squadron, 3rd Cavalry Regiment cross saber. And so that's one of the things that kind of Sergeant Major Reed and Colonel Quinn kind of put in as the association began to grow. It was, hey, let's start a gift shop. 1st Cav had a gift shop on post at their museum, so they put one in our museum at that time, and we've just kind of grown from there.
Do you ever have kind of those clandestine veterans who are just scattered to the four winds reach out to you regarding anything? I mean, it just could be personal needs. It could be just a, having a touch point with somebody from 3CR that they need in that moment. Do you ever have those types of interactions?
Yes. So I've had a few of those, and it could be, you know, something as random as I had one guy who lives up in the Waco area. He's disabled. He lost both of his legs. I don't know if it was due to combat, but he served in Vietnam. He lost both of his legs at some point. He wasn't going to be able to come to the reunion, but he had something he wanted to share. He created a song using some sort of AI program, and he wanted to share it with us to see if it was something we'd be interested in. And so, you know, he sent it. We listened to it. Oh, you know, this is pretty good. You know, we shared it with the leadership as something that, you know, the regiment already has a song, but this was just kind of something to celebrate, like some of the different periods dating all the way back to Chapultepec and stuff like that. So that was one interaction that I had. Some of the other interactions that I've had, so we did a couple meet and greets out in El Paso. So the regiment was based at Fort Bliss for a while, and there's still a lot of guys from the 70s and 80s who were in the regiment when it was at Fort Bliss. They've kind of been yearning to have more touch points. So I was like, okay, hey, we'll come out there. We'll set up a meet and greet. They want to start a chapter out there. So I was like, okay, well, let's kind of gauge the interest and we'll kind of see how things are. First one was we had about maybe 30 folks that came out. Second one, we only had 3 guys that showed up. And I mean, part of it is timing, right? Part of it is location. So most of the guys that I've interacted with, some of them are like from the Las Cruces area, which is about 45 minutes to an hour away, depending on where you are. And so, you know, those are some of the things that we're learning to navigate to try to figure out, like, how do we have these touch points with the veterans of our formation, right? Because like you said, they're spread out all over the country.
Sure.
I mean, we have a couple in Germany. We had my former supply sergeant who lives in Korea now. She wow. came here for the reunion. So, you know, we had one guy who was like, he came from...
That's right. You introduced me to her, I think, at yes. the garden party.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, so awesome. Master Sergeant retired Minji Han
yeah.
came to the the reunion. She came from Korea. But we had Joseph Massa, who lives in Nevada.
Okay.
And, you know, one thing, he's a car guy. I'm a car guy. So one thing that they'll do at car shows is, like, are you the furthest traveled? Like, did you travel the farthest to get here?
Yeah.
So one of the questions he's asking me is like, hey, you know, who traveled the farthest to get here? And I was like, well, some people come from Florida. We had some people come from DC, but the furthest traveled came from Korea. Yeah.
Well, I'm convinced and I'm optimistic. And it's not just because I'm a chaplain. I'm optimistic that even though we kind of say that troopers today or soldiers today isolate themselves when they're not having to go to work, like they're isolated from each other, their social life is on their phones, I'm convinced that someday there will be a group of troopers from this organization that are much younger than us that will come together in some capacity, or will just have a desire to be a part of the association because of the memories that they have. Because as you know, having served more than a day in the Army, is you don't know how good it is until you've left. But in the moment, it doesn't seem like it's a great thing that you're having to deal with, going to formations and turning cranks on JLTVs and strikers. But once that's gone and those relationships are in a sense dissolved because you PCS'd or you got out of the Army, you really miss what you had. So
yeah, so one advantage I think with the social media that this younger generation is going to have is the ability to maintain contact with some of those troopers that they're serving with, right?
Yes.
So they're battle buddies that they have. Whereas, you know, some of the guys that I served with when I was in 212 Cav, I mean, I have no idea where they are.
Yeah.
Right? Because we didn't have social media then. And that was, for the most part, before most people had cell phones too. And so people changed numbers as they went from duty station to duty station or as they got out of the service. And so if you didn't have some sort of physical contact with them, then you probably lost contact and you never regained it. And so that's one of the challenges for us, is trying to build the association to be able to reach out to more of the older veterans and bring them back into the fold and hopefully get them to come either to a meet and greet or to the reunion, you know, like Joseph Massa when he came and some of the other individuals that came to the reunion, you know, they thoroughly enjoyed it, not just because they got to kind of relive their regiment days, their Brave Rifles days, but they also got to meet some of the young troopers. They also got to kind of go around to the different buildings and see, like, what does the formation look like now? And so guys that served in the 70s when we had M60 patent tanks, they don't see any tanks. They were seeing Strikers, but it was still something cool for them to see.
Well, and that seems like that is, I don't want to say it's a tenuous place to be, but maybe it is because there are advantages, obviously, in social media and that it'll bring more people together. But it's so good to, like, see people in person. I didn't really know anybody at the reunion dinner that you all had, but it was just great to be around a whole bunch of veterans that had shared time at different eras within an organization and just see them hanging out with each other and having fellowship.
Yep.
There's just something very powerful about that. So it would certainly be my hope that despite the fact that many younger generations will stay connected, like you said, via social media, that they'll also find times to come together in person.
Yes.
Because there's power in that. So, well, Colonel Hernandez, I really appreciate having you on the show. And for our listeners, join the association. I'll leave it at that, unless you want to add some more. I know that you were in the shop regularly, in the gift shop. And so hopefully you'll continue to have some great opportunities to recruit troopers, young troopers, to join the association. Because really, they're the future of this organization, as you know. We're long gone. They're the ones that are going to be kind of carrying the torch.
Exactly.
Again, really appreciate having you on, Jeff, and look forward to seeing you at the shop or at another event down the road.
Yep, we'll be having a meet and greet here probably in the September timeframe here in the Killeen area.
Okay.
And looking at an opportunity maybe in the November, December timeframe doing a meet and greet out in El Paso. And for troopers who are interested in knowing what's going on with the association, just follow our Facebook page. That's where we do a lot of our announcements and stuff because we're trying to leverage the social media engagement.
Yeah.
And we're probably going to be trying to expand into like Snapchat and Twitter or X, whatever it's called these days. I'm just trying to learn the ropes for all that so that I can increase our outreach.
Awesome. Well, thank you. And we'll talk again.
Thanks, Chaplain, for having me.
Absolutely. If you liked what you heard on Legends Among Us, please subscribe to the podcast, leave some comments, have a great weekend. Ah, yeah.